Live and local from the 237 Roof Studios in Upper Lafayette. We are Acadiana's sports station. 1037 The Game. KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time to step your game up.
Boy, you wouldn't know how to write your name if it wasn't stepped on your locker.
It's Rap Game with RP3. Raymond Parts III.
One of God's own prototypes. A high-powered mutant of some kind never even considered for mass production. Too weird to live, too rare to die.
Want to interact? Call in at 337-706-0111.
We have it. Yeah, we have it.
RP3 is taking the mic and bringing you to the center of the sports world on Rap Game with RP3 on 1037 The Game and 1037thegame.com.
You just got to keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
Solid. I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
Mooney up the floor. Three on the left wing. That is no good. Rebound pulled down by DeAndre Hunter. And they're going to dribble it out. From ruin to redemption, the Virginia Cavaliers are the 2019 NCAA National Champions. 85-77, Virginia wins its first men's basketball championship.
But now it shows that one shining moment you reached deep inside. In one shining moment you knew you were alive.
Good morning, Acadiana. This is Raymond Parts III, your host for the Rap Game with RP3 right here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Give us a call today on the ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. We got a jam-packed show for you here on from 6 to 8 today. In the second hour, we'll have our good friend Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast joining us, breaking down some Saints free agency and looking forward to the draft, which, by the way, will be here in just a few weeks. It's already crept up on us. We got so focused and distracted by the Final Four, we forgot about the NFL draft, Cody. It's coming up April 25th.
Shame on you.
I know. Shame on me. Shame on me. We'll also talk to the Cajun Kiwi, Acadiana's own Craig Perks.
Best golfer I know?
It is the best golfer you know. Best golfer I know, too.
Best golfer I know.
Best golfer everyone here at 103.7 The Game knows. The one and only Craig Perks, host of Perks of the Game. He'll join us at the end of the second hour, help us preview this week's Masters. We'll also look at UL hosting Louisiana Tech at the Teague tonight, as well as a little LSU at Southern baseball, which is also tonight. But we'll start off with the Final Four.
But now
your face tells me you do not enjoy the One Shining Moment song.
Unpopular opinion, I hate it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's unpopular. It's a polarizing song at this point. At one point, it was like, oh my God, this has to play every year, da da da. You know, however many years later now, it's kind of a split thing. I think it's hilarious because
why
they still
do you make it so over-the-top sappiness for a damn basketball tournament?
You're talking to a wrestling fan, so I'm down for the pageantry, and you're also talking to a guy that had to stop watching The Biggest Loser because he would just, like, want to cry every time he watched these out-of-shape people lose weight. So a nice triumphant montage set to a some sort of power ballad or anything like that. You know, yeah, I'm game. I'm always down for that. But your face, when I hit that this morning, it was written all over your face. I do not. Teddy Pendergrass, you at least like Teddy P, right?
I do respect Teddy P.
Okay.
I have probably Teddy P greatest hits somewhere in my collection.
Okay.
Okay. But it's just so cheesetastic. It's so unnecessary.
But now it shows that one shining moment inside.
Terrible.
And one shining moment, Raymond. Congratulations to the UVA Cavaliers.
That's right. Virginia Cavaliers. We made jokes about it. We even had a Twitter poll question. Would the winner of this game score more than 60 points? Because both of them were marched through the tournament with defensive efforts, in particular Virginia, known for its defense. And not only did they score more than 60 points, Virginia won this game with offense, which is amazing to me that a team known for its defense ended up winning its first national championship by scoring 85 points. 85. We thought that there was no way that this game, the winner would score more than the women's game on Sunday, and we were proven wrong.
Can I just say, it's very reminiscent to me of, I understand in 2009 the Saints defense was a ball-hawking defense and all that. I get that, but the team was known for its offense, and then in the Super Bowl, it's a pick six that seals the deal for the Saints. This was similar to me in the sense of, I was expecting, you know, like we were saying, a very low-scoring game, and then all of a sudden it comes out and it's, you know, raining threes everywhere, and the offense is going rim-rocking and stuff, and it's like, where's this team been?
Yeah, that's a good comparison. I also think of it, you know, a lot of times we'll have, like you said, like a Super Bowl, we'll have an NFC Championship game, defense, 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 and then, you know, they explode, or Clemson and Alabama play for the national championship, and they both have top five defenses, and they put up 45 and 50 points. You know, it's like, well, okay, that defense is out the window.
You want to slap the guy that's trying to be over in the corner and be like, I saw this coming. I told you guys. And you slap him.
No. Virginia did erupt for 85 points. DeAndre Hunter missed his first seven shots. He scored 27 points and made 4 3-pointers and was 7-9 from the free throw line after having a terrible start to the game. Kyle Guy, the hero from the Final Four game, the semifinal game, he added 24 points, and Ty Jerome had 8 assists. Virginia did do something extremely smart. They repeatedly held the ball late into the shot clock, if you were watching the game. And then they just let Jerome create a shot off the dribble. Once again, the storyline, and congratulations to Texas Tech to make it to not only their first Final Four and get to the championship game, and they lose in overtime, is nothing to hang their head about. That was a tremendous run, and if Chris Beard stays, he's now, in the past few years, taken a program that has zero basketball history that's relevant. They had Bob Knight as their coach, but they didn't get far in the tournament, okay? They had a big-name coach who Beard was mentored by, but they didn't do anything. Since he's been there, the former Little Rock coach has guided the Texas Tech Red Raiders to the Elite Eight, then this year to their first Final Four appearance and national runner-up. It's a terrific job by him. I'm sure UCLA, who cannot find a coach to come to them, will now throw as much money as possible at Chris Beard and try to get him to come be their coach. And he'll probably turn them down. That's a discussion for another day. But the story of this team going from being the first number one seed in NCAA tournament history to lose to a 16, which just seemed to be the exclamation point on Tony Bennett and Virginia basketball, as, yes, they have this great defense that slows down the pace, and they can sometimes beat Duke and North Carolina during the regular season, and they win regular season ACC titles, and they get a high seed in the tournament, but they always disappoint you. They always let you down. And that was the narrative with Virginia losing last year. I mean, that pretty much sealed their fate in the minds of a lot of people when it came to college basketball. And they embraced that, and they accepted that. And then this year's team went out there, and that's all we heard, right? The narrative was, hell, who picked Virginia in their brackets? Not many people. The narrative was they can't win the big game. Tony Bennett's a really good coach. He's a regular season coach. His team falters when he gets to the postseason. He's not a postseason coach. This is not a postseason program. They're not the best team out of the ACC. They're not making it to the Elite Eight. They're not making it to the Final Four. Don't be surprised. You even had talk of them losing again as a one seed. And here they are, a year later, and they have won their first national championship in program history, with the majority of the guys on last year's team being on this year's team. It's a veteran-laden team. And for them to be able to do this and to own the fact that they were the first team to lose to a 16 seed when they lost last year to UMBC, to go through the tournament. And this team was tested throughout the tournament. They were tested by Oregon. Okay? They were tested by Auburn. And then they were, of course, tested last night by Texas Tech. They overcame all those tests. They overcame all those challenges. And they did it, and now they're national champions. They use that slow tempo that people have been very critical about, yet it helped them win a national championship. They got offensive scoring when they need to with Jerome and Guy. I mean, think about that when they were tested in the tournament against the Boilermakers, against Purdue. That's a game that Purdue probably should have won, right? That's the your one shining moment play where the free throws miss, the pass gets put back into the backcourt, the Virginia player grabs it, throws it to his guy, who does it with the putback as time has expired to force overtime. They were tested by Oregon. They were tested by Purdue. But in Purdue, they had guys, these veteran guys, step up. Jerome and Guy combined for 49 points and made 9 three-pointers against Purdue. Just a tremendous performance by Virginia. It was a heck of a ball game. It exceeded expectations. It was not nearly as ugly as we all anticipated it being. And congratulations to Tony Bennett. We talked about it this week on the show. We talked about it last week even, Cody. It felt like this was Tony Bennett's year, just like it was for Jay Wright at Villanova, the breakthrough year to win the national championship and get the monkey off your back.
Oh, Tony Bennett, I'd like to talk to you. Oh, I want to make a movie about your wonderful basketball team. Oh.
I'm just saying.
And now we turn to the offseason, and now we'll turn to Chris Beard being the most coveted coach in the NCAA, the head coach for the Texas Tech Red Raiders, with John Calipari flirting and then turning UCLA down, and then Rick Barnes, the Tennessee coach, doing the same thing, got himself a nice pay raise. UCLA is being used to get people pay raises. Will Chris Beard do the same? We'll see. This is a guy who was a longtime assistant at Texas Tech. He loves the Red Raiders. And you just led the Texas Tech Red Raiders to the national championship game. If you take money off the table, Texas Tech is a better basketball program right now than UCLA.
If you can win,
I can give you 50 better basketball programs than UCLA right now.
Right now.
At least. Yeah.
If you can win a national championship with Texas Tech basketball next season, Disney will scrap the movie about Virginia and then they'll start making the one about Texas Tech.
Yeah, that's the thing for UCLA. You can throw all the money you want, but Tennessee's a better program than you. Like, Kentucky, maybe you shouldn't have got rid of Ben Howland that led you to 4 straight Final Fours and 1 national championship runner-up. I don't know.
I'm trying to remember the last time UCLA was good.
Russell Westbrook, Kevin Love.
That's about it.
Yeah. Coached by Ben Howland, who's now at Mississippi State. Yeah. Because UCLA was like, oh, you won over 20 games and won a regular season title, but you lost in the NCAA tournament too early? You got to go. That's not good enough for us. Okay, Bruins, how's that work it out for you? You're quickly becoming the Nebraska of college basketball. Congratulations. When we come back, we'll talk more tourney talk right here on the Rap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to the Rap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III, here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live, as always, 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. You want to give us a call? Pick up the phone. Dial 337-706-0111. Once again, the ARCO Equipment Hotline number is 337-706-0111. We spent the first segment discussing last night's pretty entertaining national championship game between Virginia and Texas Tech. So where does that put us now? And I think there's an interesting thing to look at, because the one-and-done era has kind of dominated college basketball. But if you look at the teams that reached the Final Four and the teams that play for national championships, you're going to be hard-pressed to find one-and-done players. You're going to be hard-pressed to find lottery picks. So what's happened? Even before the NBA instituted its one-and-done, what we call the one-and-done rule, in 2005, you had guys that would go to college. You could either leave, go high school, go straight in like Kevin Garnett did, or Kobe Bryant, or LeBron James. But you still had guys, even before that era of the official one-and-done rule that began with the 2006 draft. The rule was implemented in 2005 for the 2005-2006 season. You had guys like Chris Bosh, who was only a one-year player at Georgia Tech, or Carmelo Anthony, a one-year player at Syracuse when he won the national championship. Luol Deng is another one. He only spent 1 year at Duke, 2003 to 2004. So you had guys that were good enough. They were probably getting some buzz out of high school, but they decided to go to college anyway, and they just went for the 1 year. But 2005 on, with the 2006 draft, is when things really kind of ratcheted up. And early on, you had a slew of one-and-done guys that were actually in the mix at the Final Four. I'll give you 2007-08 season. That was Kevin Love, Russell Westbrook for that UCLA team that made it to the Final Four. Even before then, you had other guys. I also think of the year before that, Greg Oden and Mike Conley Jr. Both were one-and-done players for Ohio State. They advanced all the way to the national championship game, which they lost to Florida, which, by the way, had a bunch of veteran guys who were all juniors on that team. So early on, the one-and-doners were competing for Final Fours, were in the mix for national championship games. 07, 08. I also think even as far back, 07, 08, that was also the same year as Kevin Love, Russell Westbrook. That was also the same year of Derrick Rose when he led Memphis as a freshman. He ended up being the number one overall pick the next year's draft. That was, of course, a team coached by John Calipari. So you had these guys, these one-and-doners, and these programs that embraced them, making an impact, playing in the Final Four, playing for national championships. But that's changed. And it's interesting how that's kind of shifted now. You had the great Kentucky team, the 2011-2012 team. That's the one that had Anthony Davis, who went number one overall, of course, to the New Orleans Pelicans. Also had Michael Kidd-Gilchrist that went number two overall. They won the national championship that year. But with the exception of Duke, a few years after that, your one-and-done players, your lottery picks that everyone covets and everyone talks ad nauseum about, have not been part of postseason runs, have not been part of the Final Four, have not been part of the national championship conversation. that's interesting to me. I'll give you some names. Kyrie Irving was the number one overall pick, a one-and-done player. He only played 11 games. Duke lost in the Sweet 16 that year. That was 2011. Andrew Wiggins, number one overall pick, one-and-doneer for Kansas. 2014, they lost in the second round of the NCAA tournament. Trae Young, sensational shooting guard for Oklahoma. National Player of the Year candidate. Lottery pick, top 10 pick at that. Went fifth overall. This was just 2017-18. They lost in the second round, or they lost in the first round or the second round to Rhode Island. Over and over again, you'll see this. D'Angelo Russell, 2014-15 season for Ohio State, one and done player, lottery pick, lost in the round of 32. DeAndre Ayton, same draft class as Trae Young, just a year ago. Number one overall pick. His team lost to the 13 seed Buffalo team in the first round of the NCAA tournament. And of course, the one that we know better than anything, Ben Simmons. Lottery pick. LSU didn't even qualify for the NCAA tournament that year. And then, of course, this year, the biggest name in college basketball was Zion Williamson. They didn't get to the Final Four. So it's interesting to me. Is it just a blip? Has it just been something that's occurred since essentially 2015 when Duke won the national championship? And Kentucky made it to the Final Four with some one-and-done players. But that Kentucky team and the 11-12 Kentucky team and that one Duke team seem to be the outliers. They're the exception to the rule for the one-and-done era. After we got over those first 3 to 4 years, it seems like the teams that are competing for Final Fours, making it to Final Fours and competing for national championships, are the teams with veteran players and not the one-and-done lottery picks. So the type of teams that you saw recently in the tournament, like Butler, Villanova, and now Virginia, that could be the norm moving forward. When we come back, we'll talk the state of the SEC with the coaches and the Will Wade situation right here on the Rap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to the Rap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III, right here on 103.7 The Game. The man on the ones and twos is Cody Schutz. And we're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. Started off today's show talking about the NCAA Men's National Championship game between Texas Tech and Virginia. Ended up being an entertaining one, went to overtime, and the Wahoos brought home their first national championship in program history, did so in overtime. Congratulations to Tony Bennett and his squad for overcoming that. And we talked about how they embraced the fact that they were the first one seed to lose to a 16 seed. They owned it. They used it as motivation. And now they're national champions. Finally got off the schneid. So congratulations to them. Also, congratulations to the Texas Tech Red Raiders. Tremendous season. Breaking through, getting to their first Final Four, and then getting to the national championship game and coming oh so close to winning it all. But now I want to focus on what's occurring in Baton Rouge, or more to the point, what's not going on in Baton Rouge. Big up to the good brother Ben Love for bringing this up on his show yesterday. And I want to kind of take his points and kind of further elaborate on them. LSU is dragging their feet with the Will Wade situation. And it could be ultimately costly. on the surface, you go, well, Ray, Naz Reid was going to leave anyway. You're right. We talked about Naz Reid coming to LSU and being a one-and-done player when he initially verbally committed. So him leaving is to be expected. It's also to be expected that Tremont Waters would leave. He flirted with leaving last year after LSU advanced to the second round of the NIT. He flirted. He decided to come back for his sophomore season. Ends up earning all SEC first team honors and is named the co-defensive player of the year in the league. That is just as expected. What's not as expected is the fact when Skylar Mays announced on Friday that he was bolting for the NBA. And that's the thing that if I'm an LSU fan, I worry about. That cat is the lifeblood, the heartbeat of this team. He was the leader and the heart of this team. This is a guy who doesn't need to go to the pros. This is a guy that doesn't need to go to the NBA. He has a 4.1 GPA. He's going to be a doctor. Now, Skylar's performance is the best it's been since he's been at LSU. He came up big. He came up big when Tremont Waters was out for a couple games with injuries. He helped develop Javonte Smart. They had a great rapport on the court together. Javonte was better on the court when he's playing alongside Skylar than he was with Tremont Waters. Skylar brought out the best out of his guys, his teammates. He knew how to calm them down. He in particular knew how to calm down Javonte because Javonte has just so much energy, the former Scotlandville Magnet star, that he would get out there, he'd get too amped up sometimes, right? And Skylar was great about throwing up those alley-oops to Marlon Taylor. But for him to leave? I mean, when we talked about what next year's LSU team was going to look like, it was, well, it's going to be Skylar Mays out there with a bunch of dudes. And now there will be no Skylar Mays. So as of right now, three of your five starters from this year's SEC regular season championship team and a team that advanced to the Sweet 16 for the first time since 2006 are gone. Cavell Bigby Williams graduated. Naz Reid declares for the draft. Tremont Waters declares for the draft. Sorry, now four or five. Skylar Mays now declares for the draft. So four of your starting five are gone. This is what Kentucky has to deal with because they have all the one-and-done players. LSU, you have two guys, you have only one of those guys as a one-and-done. Only one. One guy's graduating. One guy's a one-and-doneer. One guy's leaving after 2 years, and the other guy's now leaving after his junior season, and you're expecting him to come back and be the leader of this team and be your best player and build around him. Now, I know they got talent on that team. You still got Darius Days. You still got Marlon Taylor. I get that. But this tells me that those guys in that locker room don't believe that the Will Wade situation is going to be resolved, and more importantly, do not believe that Will Wade is going to be their coach. Or that Tony Benford is going to be their coach. Because that's the other thing. That deal is not finalized. But multiple reporting has come out that Buzz Williams, the new head coach at Texas A&M, a man who's won at Marquette and has won at Virginia Tech, do you have any idea how hard it is to win in those places? A guy with immense relationships throughout Texas and Louisiana. Buzz Williams coached under Mike McConathy at Northwestern State. He has connections throughout the state of Louisiana. There's going to be a lot of guys that LSU is going to have to recruit with Buzz Williams. Not to mention now, Texas A&M is giving you their two most important coaches. Their names are Jimbo and Buzz, and that sounds like a terrific 80s sitcom that we deserve to have. But that's a side note.
Or an Uncle Jimbo-centric episode of South Park.
Buzz Williams can coach his tail end off. And he is boys with Tony Benford. And the guy who had to serve as your interim coach for the LSU men's basketball program while Will Wade is being suspended. That hasn't been finalized yet, but A&M is probably going to try to back up the Brinks truck to get him. So now you're minus four. You're four of your five starters from the Sweet 16 team. You're one of your assistant coaches, and the man who served as interim coach while your head coach was suspended looks like he's trying to someone's trying to poach him away. And LSU is sitting on their hands. Because here's the more important thing. The longer they wait with this Will Wade situation, and if you talk to certain media members, they will tell you that they're waiting until after the April 22nd trial date where Will Wade has been subpoenaed to testify in the federal corruption trial with college basketball. Now, he may go to that trial. He may plead the fifth. He may say, I got nothing to say. Or he may reveal things that are said. He may reveal what his relationship is with Christian Dawkins, the low-level go-between man for the shoe companies and an agent wannabe. So we don't know. But this hurts them. And this hurts them because of this reason. Look around the SEC. It's getting better. You're having teams that are wanting to compete, and they feel like their time is now, and they're tired of just being a football school, and they're tired of just being an afterthought, and they're tired of being mediocre. A&M hiring Buzz Williams is comparable to A&M hiring Jimbo Fisher. Buzz just doesn't have the national championship under his belt. He's that level kind of coach. A&M is dedicating themselves to be a force in the SEC and nationally with their football and their men's basketball program. They went out and they hired one of the best damn coaches out there. A guy who's going to come into the state of Louisiana and recruit Louisiana kids, by the way. Heads up, he's going to do the same thing that Jimbo's going to do at A&M. Buzz is a tremendous coach. So A&M adds Buzz Williams, who's trying to add his good friend and longtime guy that he worked alongside, who just so happened to be the interim coach at LSU. Alabama gets rid of Avery Johnson because the way the programs try to tailspin this year, 1 year after winning an NCAA tournament game, Alabama wants to win in basketball. They go out and hire the Buffalo head coach, poach him away from the small school. He has led Buffalo to back-to-back NCAA tournament wins. We're getting better. Alabama wants to get better. They get a new, younger, dynamic head coach. Texas A&M gets a new head coach. Arkansas. Arkansas just hired the man who led the Nevada Wolfpack to the Elite Eight in the last few years. Nevada. They had their own television special on Stadium. Arkansas went out and got themselves a new. Now, Musselman is not young, but he's a dynamic coach.
Also spent a handful of years at LSU.
There you go. Because who's he boys with? Johnny Jones.
Johnny Jones, yeah.
So yeah. So, new head coach in Arkansas, new head coach in Texas A&M, new head coach in Alabama. All three of those teams are in the SEC West, yes? Okay. And we've seen the job that Ben Howland's doing at Mississippi State, correct? The former UCLA head coach that went to four straight Final Fours. He got Mississippi State into the tournament, NCAA tournament this year. We saw what Kermit Davis has done at Ole Miss. He's turned them around. He was named the SEC Coach of the Year. Rick Barnes is going to get a huge contract extension and a far more money for not going to UCLA and staying at Tennessee. You got John Calipari at Kentucky. We saw the improvements that Mike White has done at Florida. By the way, a Florida team that beat LSU not once but twice this year. The SEC is making a conscious effort to not only be a football conference, but to be one of the best basketball conferences in the nation. Tennessee was a number one ranked team in the country this year. Kentucky made it all the way to the Elite Eight. And what's going to happen to LSU? The longer they drag on with this, the longer this drags out with them and their Will Wade situation, it's going to hurt recruiting. And a lot of those guys, they would try to be getting to come in, those recruits to come to Baton Rouge. You know where they're going to go now? Arkansas, A&M, Alabama. And what if this situation dissolves where they have to part ways? And then LSU's going to have to find a head coach in May for their men's basketball program? How many of those kids left on the roster are going to stay on there? How many of those guys are going to transfer during the summer? What's Javonte Smart going to do? This whole thing is an absolute train wreck from start to finish. And LSU could go from being in the Sweet 16 this season to not having a single starter return, not have their interim coach back, not have their head coach back, and be a team that's near the bottom of the SEC. Oh, and we forgot about Vanderbilt. They went out and got Jerry freaking Stackhouse to be their head coach. A guy who did a great job in the G League to be their new head coach. Everyone's getting all these new head coaches. Everyone's getting these dynamic guys to come into the SEC to try to make the SEC the best basketball conference in the country, on par with the ACC. And LSU is like, we can't even get a meeting with our head coach.
And I wonder, we don't have enough time to discuss this, but you brought it up twice and it makes me think. I wonder, because of the ACC, which is perennially one of the best basketball conferences in the country.
Yeah, because Duke and North Carolina.
Right. Yeah. But I wonder if because of Clemson and Florida State for a little while, and those schools catching up a little bit in football, has maybe pushed the SEC to want to try to catch up in basketball, kind of play the reverse role there.
They're just greedy. They want to dominate everything.
And that's okay. I don't have a problem with that.
And if you're these schools, that's what you want, right?
Right.
So
a monopoly, if you will.
But what's going to happen, man, if it's May and they fire Will Wade or they part ways and they reach a settlement? Who the hell are you going to get to coach LSU in May when all the best coaches are gone? What are you going to do then?
Just go find that next Will Wade, that's all. One that's a little bit smarter.
And doesn't talk to guys like Christian Dawkins.
That's what I meant by smarter.
Yeah. Bravo, bravo, touche. When we come back, we will wrap up this first hour of the Rap Game with RP3. Drew Holiday getting some love from the rest of the NBA. That's right, his fellow competitors giving him some dap. We'll talk about it right here on 103.7 The Game.
On the drive, here's Holiday. Corner left three. Good, good, good. Timeout San Antonio.
So Atlanta's trying to get cooking offensively. It's 36-18. Howard's getting a lot of stuff off the lob, and now the Pelicans turn it over. Delaney turns it right back over. Pass stolen by Holiday to the rim. Dunks with two hands. Drew Holiday says, I'll take that turnover right back.
Welcome back to the Rap Game with RP3 here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. The New Orleans Pelicans wrap up a forgettable and drama-filled, like a very much a keeping up with the kind of Kardashians type of season. Tonight, they're in the big blender across from the Superdome. They're at the Smoothie King Center when they welcome in the Golden State Warriors, who are resting essentially everyone except for Boogie Cousins, who wants to play against the Pels, which should be interesting.
Steve Kerr might take the floor tonight. It'll be fun to watch.
They're going to be in the lottery. Dale Demps fired. Deservedly so. Anthony Davis, trade drama, forced the hand for them to do that. He'll be traded during this offseason. They're a bad team, but they show a lot of heart. We talked a lot about that. But the Athletic did a survey with NBA players. And they did, who deserves to, be the MVP. They asked them multiple questions. But one of the things they asked was, who do you believe is the most overrated player in the NBA, and who you believe is the most underrated player in the NBA? overrated was Draymond Green.
It's probably not the first time he's won that.
And Russell Westbrook.
Oh, they tied? Really?
Yeah, which I was surprised by.
That seems like a personality thing. I think there's just a lot of dudes in the NBA that don't like Russ. But to say he's overrated, IDK fam.
The three players that earned the most votes for being considered underrated in the association. This is by the players. This is not by coaches or media people. This is strictly polling the players that play in the NBA. Chris Middleton, he's a good player, underrated. Dame Lillard,
Is he underrated?
I think so, because he plays in Portland. I think he's got that whole Pacific Northwest thing that no one catches their games and no one really pays attention to him. He's undersized. And he's a trailblazer. You're going to be you're underrated by default.
I guess maybe in the eyes of the league, but in the eyes of the fans, I don't know if that's the case. But I could see if you're in the league and you know a guy is as good as Damian Lillard and he plays in Portland, and then you've got guys like...
He's also not flashy. That's part of it, too. You understand what I'm saying? Like,
right. Now, in the eyes of the fans, I don't think a fan would ever say Dame Lillard is overrated or underrated, excuse me. But I guess I could see maybe as a colleague of his, as a peer, so to speak, of his in the league, I guess I could see
that. If you polled fans, do you think Dame Lillard is one of the top 10 players that they name?
I think so.
With LeBron and Kevin Durant and Steph Curry top 10, and Klay
yes.
Thompson.
Top 5, no. But top 10, yes.
Anthony Davis. I don't know. It's an interesting point, though. But
he's on that cusp, for sure. We'll agree to say that. He's on that cusp of 10 to 15.
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah. I would say maybe like from 8 to 15. Yeah, he's in that area.
Yeah.
But the third one was our boy Drew Holiday, who was considered one of the most underrated players. And we talk about it all the time how we feel that he's one of the best two-way players in the league. A lot of people are pushing for him to earn all NBA defensive team honors this year. That probably won't happen because the Pels are awful. That said, he deserves it. And he's turned into a heck of a player. He's come a long way from when he was drafted into the NBA by the 76ers. And was injury prone early in his career. He has turned a corner and he has developed into one of the best two-way players in the league. Once again, proof, if you keep working at it, and you just keep working at it, and a team gives you time to develop, you can turn yourself into a hell of a professional ball player. And that's exactly what Drew does, has done, and more importantly, the rest of the guys in the league respect what he does too. When we come back, our friend Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast is going to be joining us talking Saints free agency and the draft right here on 103.7 The Game.
Live and local from the 237 Roof Studios in Upper Lafayette, we are Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game, KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time to step your game up.
Boy, you wouldn't know how to write your name if it wasn't stepped on your locker.
It's Rep Game with RP3, Raymond Parts III.
One of God's own prototypes. A high-powered mutant of some kind never even considered for mass production. Too weird to live, too rare to die.
Want to interact? Call in at 337-706-0111.
We have it.
RP3 is taking the mic and bringing you to the center of the sports world on Rep Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game and 1037thegame.com.
You just got to keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
Welcome to the second hour of the Rap Game with RP3 right here on 103.7 The Game. Broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. First hour was a lot of basketball talk and deserving. So we talked about Virginia defeating Texas Tech in overtime to claim the NCAA men's championship. First national championship in basketball for the Wahoos. Congratulations to them, especially that story. I even saw it. 30 for 30 tweeted out, what if I told you? And there was a picture of them losing last year to UMBC and then winning this year for the national championship.
Oh, Raymond, this is my second appearance on your show this morning. Oh, Raymond, I've already been in contact with Virginia for the movie rights. Oh, Raymond.
Sorry. I'm just saying, if this doesn't have Rookie of the Year or something like that written all over it, I mean,
it's a Hollywood ending, right?
I don't know if they can pull it away.
It's the Hollywood ending.
I don't know if they can pull one a big. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, but 30 for 30, the actual ESPN 30 for 30 account tweeted out that.
Well, no, but that's a 30 for 30. It writes itself. I mean, all the 30 for 30s kind of write themselves, but I mean, that's easy 30. I could see the Purdue game in the March Madness tournament. I forget what round was that.
That would have been the Elite Eight.
Elite Eight. So Elite Eight, I could see that being that, you know how movies, like, it starts off low. Boom, they lose in the first round in that previous year. And then they have a good offseason.
No, it's nothing but montage of negative headlines.
Right.
Tony Bennett's terrible.
Exactly.
Virginia's not built for the postseason.
And then it goes into the following season, and they have a great year. They're number one. They do this. They do that, whatever have you. They get into the tournament. They're doing great. And then you hit that second lull in that Purdue game, you know, and halftime is a big thing or something in the movie.
The Oregon game, too.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you have a where it's these last-second shots to win, da-da-da. And the movie itself can end going into the national. It's kind of like a Remember the Titans. Like, we don't even need to see the national championship game in the movie. It can go, you know, fade to black when they win in the Final Four, and then you can do that whole white text on the screen. Virginia goes on to win in the national.
Nice. And then maybe like
with one shining moment playing in the background, of course.
And then maybe like during training camp, they can all listen to Motown and come together and overcome all their differences.
Yeah, maybe make a little dance routine or something when they want to come out on the court for their warm-ups or something like that.
Unpopular opinion.
Uh-huh.
I'm not a fan of Remember the Titans.
Oh, see, we're going to fight. How are you not a fan of that?
It's schmaltzy. It's just so sugary sweet, and it's just like, oh, you know, it's a lot of the stuff that happened really didn't happen. Okay, it's based on the true story.
I would never call Remember the Titans sugary sweet. Gary Bertier, man, he didn't even get to play in the game. Just saying.
Didn't even get to play in the game. It's an okay movie. It's not one of my favorites. But we talked about NCAA men's tournament, Virginia taking down Texas Tech. We also talked about the LSU and Will Wade situation, or lack of anything going on. And as LSU painted themselves in a corner where all these other SEC teams, and particularly all these SEC West teams, are hiring dynamic coaches to win now. Is that going to hurt them if they have to part ways with Will Wade, say, come at the end of April or the end of May? And then they're looking around going, well, who the hell are we going to hire now? And we also talked about Drew Holiday getting love and respect from the rest of the NBA, from the players saying that he's one of the most underrated in the league. We're going to put the basketball talk behind us now. Second hour's here, and we're going to head out to the Arco Equipment Hotline and start it off strong with our good friend from the Saints Happy Hour podcast, the one and only Andrew Juge. Andrew, how are you this morning, brother?
Doing well, Raymond. Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad you were able to come on with us, as always, brother. Let's talk a little bit. It's quiet now. The frenzy of free agency is kind of simmered down. Do you expect the Saints to make any more moves in between now and the draft later this month?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's possible. I mean, we just had the re-signing of P.J. Williams, so I don't think you can say definitely not, but at this point, I don't really see any imminent or expected moves. I think they'll want to get through the draft until they make a decision on what they need to add further. So I still think Ziggy Ansah is a player that they have their eye on, and the reports out there is that they're waiting for reports on how he's doing with his rehab coming off the shoulder surgery. So as we get more information about that, I think the Saints will decide, especially after the draft, if they don't feel like they've addressed their pass rushing need, then that's a move that they could potentially make. But I think right now, and as you can see from the visits and the players that they're hosting, the focus is really becoming on having those visits and making sure they understand the talent pool as well as they can so that they're ready and able to pick.
Andrew, I know they've been very creative with the cap space this offseason. They got Drew Brees to restructure his deal, push the dead money to next year. They got Cam Meredith to restructure his deal. So Mickey Loomis, Jeff Ireland, they've done a nice job of massaging things, so to speak, to free up cap space, and that's allowed them to bring back Teddy Bridgewater. That's allowed them to make some of these other moves, locking up all those guys on special team, bringing them back, giving them contract extensions, getting Brown from the Patriots along the defensive line. Where do they stand right now with their cap space? Do they have enough cap space to still sign another mid-level guy?
They should, yeah. They were at about $18 million in space, and that was prior to the Jared Cook deal and prior to the P.J. Williams deal. And P.J. Williams is a straight-up one-year $5 million contract, so that's $5 million against the cap. And then Jared Cook averages $8 million over 2 years. You look at the cap space, they're probably just under $10 million right now. They do have a little space, yes, to add another mid-level deal. So they'll need some of that space to sign the rookie draft class, but with no first-round pick, no third-round pick, no fourth-round pick, we'll see what their draft looks like, you know, on draft day. I mean, they may accrue some picks, but right now it doesn't look like their draft class will be as expensive as it has been in years past. So they won't need a lot of that cap space for that, and that's when you look at a guy like Ziggy Ansah, they would have the money to be able to add him if they need to or want to. But we'll see what happens with the draft. You know, I think one thing that's significant is that they never leave a draft without making a trade, it seems like, and making an attempt to move up.
Right.
And I've said this before on this show, Raymond, I really feel like at some point they are going to part ways with a 2020 pick to make sure they have another selection to get a guy they want in this draft.
We're on with Andrew Juger, the Saints Happy Hour podcast. Andrew, let's elaborate a little bit further on that. I agree with you. I think they're going to put all their chips in the center of the table. That's why they restructured Breeze's deal to free up cap space to get their free agents that they wanted. They targeted Jared Cook. They targeted Brown. They got their guys that they wanted, okay? And I think they feel like they got one more year with Breeze playing at a high level and that they'll just deal with the fallout next year. And why would you not go ahead and use that 2020 pick to trade back in, maybe get you a low first rounder and maybe pick up a third and pick up a couple of guys that you can have on those rookie deals while you're dealing with the dead money? I think that makes sense. Do you think, looking at the draft order, is there a team? There's always a team that wants to trade out. Like New England always wants to trade out of the first round because they love compiling the picks and getting all those second rounders and everything. New Orleans doesn't have that, but do you see a team maybe in the lower end of the first round that would maybe that the Saints could trade with possibly?
Well, I don't know that the Saints have enough draft capital and assets to really make a move in the first round. So I would be surprised to see the Saints selecting at any point. The amount they would have to give up to get into the first round would be significant. So I really think that where the Saints come into play is maybe middle of the second round and on. I would maybe see them giving up a second round pick next year to get in the top of the third round this year. That's where I think the Saints are more in play. I would say it's less maybe making a deal with teams and then, that are on the back half of the first round. I would say, it may be even teams that are picking very early in the third round is where I think you maybe see the Saints make a move. But when you look at some of these teams that have tons of picks, I mean, Cleveland and the Raiders, and especially with the Raiders and Gruden, we know Gruden and Sean Payton have a great relationship. So in the number of picks that those two teams have, those are the two teams I would have my eye on because the Raiders and Browns both have picks that are in the first half of each round. And, that's where the Saints would be wanting to move up to. So those are two teams that jump out at me just, really, with the Browns, it's just that the number of picks they have. With the Raiders, as I mentioned, the relationship with John Gruden, they also have a lot of picks, and it seems like an obvious fit.
Andrew, who do you think is – do you think that Mickey Loomis and Jeff Ireland are going to take the position of draft the best available player, or do you think there's guys in particular position players that they are really high on and that they're going to be targeting? Is it tight end? It could be the guy out of Alabama. It could be Foster Moreau at LSU. It could be the guy, the kid, he's raw, but out of West Virginia, where the Saints had 9 scouts for. And at first I thought they were there for Will Greer, and apparently they were there for the stud wide receiver and the tight end. Do you think they're going to do just best available player, or do you think there's a guy or position that they really feel that they need to solidify in this draft?
Well, if you've ever heard Sean Payton talk about their draft strategy, he calls it a bubble. You know, and as you get closer to your pick, they always have 5 players in a so-called bubble, and so then they start looking at the grade of those guys in the bubble. And the bubble is basically the guys that they have graded the highest that they would consider. And so what Sean Payton has explained in the past is that, hey, listen, if we have a guy that's graded out as a first-round level guy and we're in the second round and he's clearly a cut above everyone else, then we're going to go with best available. We're going to go with that guy. It doesn't matter. And that was certainly the case with Ryan Ramczyk. You know, at the time, the Saints didn't really feel like they needed a right tackle. They had Zach Strief on the roster. But they had Ryan Ramczyk graded out as a top 15 player, and all of a sudden he drops to the 30s, and the Saints make the call, hey, we don't really need a right tackle, but he is graded so much higher than everyone else we have in our bubble that we're going to go ahead and take this position, even though we feel pretty comfortable about where we are. And obviously that's benefited the Saints well, because now, you know, you fast forward and you look at where they are now, Zach Strief retired, and Ryan Ramczyk's got right tackle on lockdown, and he's playing very good football. So that, I think first available is always their approach, and I think they will stick with that. I think where the position need comes into play is if you've got 2 guys in that bubble that are graded very similarly. And then you start to think, okay, we could really take either of these players and be happy. So let's start to talk about our needs and what positions we need filled. You know, I think the signing of Jared Cook is huge, because now all of a sudden you have Jared Cook, you have Josh Hill, and I don't really feel like the Saints need to force tight end unless they think they have a guy that's going to really upgrade over Dan Arnold or Derek Griffin. I mean, they've got some guys on this roster, and personally, I wouldn't draft a guy at tight end unless I knew they were going to be able to compete and beat out some of those guys I just named for number 3. So tight end is a need, but you don't want to force it. It's got to be the right guy that you feel is a fit on the roster and could actually make the team. Same goes at receiver. I mean, the Saints have a lot of question marks at receiver, but you still have guys like Trick Wilson, Austin Carr, Cameron Meredith, who you just mentioned. If you're going to draft a receiver and it is a need, you've got to make sure you feel good about that player being able to compete against all those guys I just named. And if you don't really see a vision where that receiver could maybe beat out those guys, then you don't pick them. And so I think it's really staying true to your board, staying true to your grades, and even if that means drafting a position that you don't need as much.
Andrew, yeah, and one final thought. You know, they've had a couple of guys come in for pre-draft visits. Jabraylon Ferguson, the NCAA's leader in sacks, a pass rusher out of Louisiana Tech, who's projected to be maybe a second-round pick. He came in for a workout and a visit, and NFL Network has reported as well that Arizona State wide receiver N'Keal Harry is going to be visiting New Orleans ahead of the draft as well. He had other visits with the Bills, Eagles, and Patriots. So the early reports are that they're working out pass rushers and wide receivers. So really not surprised there, are you?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, I would probably list pass rusher as the number one need on this team right now, because when you look at Cameron Jordan on one side and Davenport on the other, you lose Okafor. They really have no one, maybe besides Trey Hendrickson, that's an edge guy that can get to the quarterback. So I absolutely think pass rusher is a huge need, especially when you consider how productive Sheldon Rankins was last year. You're not going to have him to begin the season, so most likely. So I think that's the number one need. But, man, I look up and down this roster, and it's a solid roster, but they need to replenish their depth. And I look up and down the team. I mean, I think receiver is a need if they can find the right guy. Offensive line, certainly at offensive tackle, I feel like they need to add a player to add to the depth there. You look at tight end, we just talked about that. I think running back is a position they could use some help at. I mean, obviously they have Latavius Murray and Kamara, but right now Dwayne Washington's your number three. If there is a running back in the third, fourth, fifth round that they really like, I would go get him because, you know, we see every year you see what Kareem Hunt was able to do as a later pick. And I just think every year there's a fifth-round draft pick running back as a rookie that comes in and surprises everyone and has a huge season. So, you know, Lindsey with the Broncos last year was an example of that. So I think running back is a position you look for because they're so cheap and, you know, a lot of times you can get them later in the draft and they can have a massive impact in the rookie season. So that's a position I look at. And then on defense, you know, we talked about pass rush, but with Manti Te'o leaving, you need a little depth at linebacker. And certainly in the secondary, it never hurts to have enough guys at safety. You know, I could see them adding some depth there. So really you go up and down this roster, and I think you feel pretty good about what you have in place with the starters. But this is all about filling out the team's depth.
Andrew, appreciate the insight as always, brother. We'll talk to you next week. Enjoy the rest of your week, my friend.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
That's Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast. You can give him a follow on Twitter, at Andrew Juge. Very simple, his name. Bravo for him for locking that up. When we come back here on the Wrap Game with RP3, UL, LSU, they have some big baseball games, midweek games tonight. We'll quickly break them down right here on 103.7 The Game. Friends, Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards has proclaimed the month of April as Safe Digging Month in Louisiana as part of a nationwide safety awareness campaign to draw attention to the importance of safe digging. In Louisiana, there are thousands of miles of utility lines and gas pipelines buried just beneath the surface. So if you or a contractor you hire is digging a hole to put in a new fence, a pool, or even a garden, you run the risk of hitting an underground line even by digging only a few inches. That's why it's so important for everyone to dial 811 and call Louisiana One Call 2 days before they dig. You just tell the operator your address and someone will come out and mark the location of buried lines so you or your contractor can avoid them. It's simple, it's free, and it's the law. All diggers and demolishers are required to notify Louisiana One Call before they begin work. The law applies to individuals as well as contractors, municipalities, and others. Failure to call can subject the individual to fines and liability for damages to buried infrastructure. Call 811 and know what's below before you dig. The LSU baseball team returns to action tonight at Southern. They're going to be playing at Lee Hines Field there in BR. You can listen to the game live right here on 103.7 The Game, pregame at 6 o'clock. First pitch at 6:30. LSU, of course, rose in the major college baseball polls. They're in most of them now in the top 10 following that taking 2 of 3 from Texas A&M over the weekend. LSU 23-10 overall will be playing a Southern team that's won 17 games this year. So they're having a pretty good season. LSU leads the all-time series, of course, 53-2. They've dominated this. They've won 14 consecutive over Southern. Landon Marceau, he was supposed to be the Saturday starter to start the season. He got roughed up a little bit, lost his confidence. They're trying to work him back into this rotation. He will be taking the bump, the heralded freshman for LSU, the big righty. 1-1 overall, 6.75 ERA. He's going to take the bump for the Tigers. He'll be facing off against Eli Finney. 1-2 overall on the season, an ERA of almost 7. This is what Paul Maneri had to say. This is going to be a tough game at Southern. Southern coach Kerrick Jackson has done a tremendous job in developing his program. They really made an improvement since the first time we played them this year, and we're going to have to be prepared for a significant challenge. I'm sure their players will be fired up to play us, especially in their ballpark. So it'll be interesting to see how Landon Marceau pitches tonight. It'll be interesting to see Southern is going to give them everything they have. will LSU have a letdown because they're not at Alex Box? They're playing across the, you know, across the city, so to speak. So that'll be interesting to see what happens with LSU. Once again, you can listen to it live right here on 103.7 The Game. Pre-game, 6 o'clock, 6:30, first pitch. The good brother Ben Love will lead you up to it from 4 to 6 right here on 103.7 The Game. When we come back after this break.
Quick programming note, Tiger Ag will play after the baseball game tonight if you're interested in that.
Yes, thank you, Cody. Thank you. When we come back, Astros took down the Yankees despite Aaron Judge hitting a ball into Kansas. just Jesus, that guy, man. My guy was built for that. We'll talk Astros beating the Yankees. We'll also preview the UL versus La Tech game tonight as well here in this next segment right here on 103.7 The Game.
This ball's belted to left field, and no doubter, Altuve over the train tracks. 1-1 ball game on Altuve's second jack of the season.
That's hit off the hands, a broken bat, dribbler right side, fielded by Bird. Somebody needs to get the first, Adovito won't get there. Bregman scores, 4-3 Astros. First pitch, and that's lined in a right field, right at Springer. Backs up a step, makes the catch, and that is the ball game. The Houston Astros win their fourth in a row, taking game one of this three-game series from the Yankees by a final of 4-3.
Welcome back to the Rap Game with RP3 right here on 103.7 The Game. I'm your host, Raymond Parts III. Cody Schutz is on the ones and twos, and we're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. If you want to give us a call, pick up the phone, dial the ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. Once again, 337-706-0111. Houston Astros, four straight victories, and they did so when Justin Verlander did not have his best stuff. As I mentioned before the break, Aaron Judge hit a home run that I think landed in Kansas off of Verlander. And Tanaka outdueled the former Cy Young Award winner. Tanaka looked amazing for the Yankees. Six terrific innings. And when he left the game, the Yankees were up 3-1. That Yankees formidable lineup got to Justin Verlander. And then the Yankees lost 4-3 because the bullpen wet themselves and the Astros took advantage there at Minute Maid. They opened up the roof and the Astros just said, okay, we got this. Tanaka threw 78 pitches. He only allowed one run and three hits. And like I said, departed with a 7-1 lead, turning the ball over to Zach Britton. And that's what happened. Britton unscored on in his four previous outings this season. Gave up a leadoff single to Carlos Correa in the seventh. Then Yuli Gurriel grounded into a force out. But that advanced the runner. And then Britton walked a batter. And then he threw a fastball to the number nine hitter, Robinson Chirinos, who hit it in the gap for a two-run double that tied the game. Boom, just like that. Adam Ottavio came in to replace Britton. He struck out Springer Dinger at the end of the seventh. He also struck out the MVP, Jose Altuve, to start the eighth. But that's when Breggs came to the plate. Bregman was walked. Then Brantley got a single to put the runners on the corners. And that's when Carrera hit the broken bat, Squibler, down the first base line for the RBI that proved to be the game-winning hit. Stros, four in a row. They take the opener against the Yanks. And once again, Verlander did not have his best stuff yesterday. You know, Verlander had been 3-0 with an ERA of under 0.6 in four starts against the Yankees since joining the Stros. That includes going 2-0 with an ERA of 0.56 in the 2017 ALCS, where he captured MVP honors. But on Monday, it was not great. 3 runs on 7 hits and just 6 innings of work. It's the first time the Yankees had scored multiple runs against him since 2015, when he was still with the Tigers. So they had the opportunity to get to Verlander. They did. They had a lead. The Yankees' bullpen crumbled, and the Astros came up big with timely hits, pulling out the win there at Minute Maid. Apparently, the roof is going to be open again today and tomorrow for the Astros games.
I mean, as it should. I feel like Houston as well as...
As it should.
Well, I just feel like Houston as well as us, we've gotten enough rain over the last couple days to where I think we're all rained out, so to speak. It's so early in the season. This is the thing about Major League Baseball to me.
Very early in the season.
When we get to talking about it, I mean, we can use the excuse from early in the season for any sport. Baseball, Major League Baseball, is the most extreme of which. But does winning at home and not on the road, does that mean anything to you yet? I mean, 4-0 at home, 1 win on the road, does that mean anything?
It's too early.
Yeah.
You're usually better at home.
Usually, yeah. I mean, that's...
You have time to get it together for the road, to be honest with you.
I don't know. I think we should start mashing the panic button.
this early. I tell you, team, that there was some panic with them for a while.
Oh, I see where this is going. Oh.
And that was the UL baseball team. And the start of their season was, let's be honest, a disappointment. They lacked consistency. They were losing weekend series to the likes of Loyola Marymount. Got swept by Sam Houston State on the road from the Southland. But it seems like they've turned a little bit of a corner. They're going to be back in action tonight as well, just like LSU is. The Raging Cajuns baseball team is going to be back in action tonight versus Louisiana Tech. They're at the Teague. First pitch is going to be 6:30 as well. And this is part of a longstanding homestand. They won their series against Arkansas State over the weekend. They got La Tech tonight. They'll host McNeese tomorrow night. And then they have the 3-game series with South Alabama this coming weekend before next week's very anticipated Wally Poniff Classic down there at the Shrine on Airline against, you guessed it, LSU.
Well, there's only one team that would be against.
Well, they have, in years past, right, they've had multiple games. They've had Tulane as part of it, too.
But I feel like that's
right, but it's always
changed.
LSU.
It's always been LSU, but LSU was doing it to where it was just one in-state school.
Right.
A year they would play, and that would be the Wally Poniff. And it would always be at the Shrine on Airline. It didn't matter right. Who the teams were. But LSU quite easily figured out, and it's pretty obvious to do so, that the biggest – because this is all for charity. This is all to raise money for the Wally Poniff Foundation and all that.
That is correct. Good cause. Great cause.
So you, LSU, took a very obvious look and saw, oh, okay, our biggest draw for this foundation is when we play the Cajuns. Regardless if the game is still in New Orleans or not, UL fans show up, LSU fans show up, and so I don't know if it's been 3 years or 4 years in a row they've done it with UL, but I'm pretty sure it's kind of solidified. It's a LSU-UL thing from here on out, as far as I know.
And the Cajuns come into this game winning 5 of 6. Their one loss was the opener on Friday this past weekend there at Teague when they dropped 12-6 versus Ark State, but then they took the doubleheader. They won 5 of 6, and look, this is a rivalry game with them and Tech. You get conflicting reports from each side. Some people say it's a rivalry, some don't. And some Tech fans don't consider UL a rivalry and vice versa. Okay, it's a rivalry. It just is.
And,
sorry.
Just to before I let you get too far off on this, because it is a rivalry, I just want to say the brother Ben letting me know that starting next year, actually, the Wally Poniff Classic is changing. It's going to be LSU Tulane. So there you go.
Nice.
I know over the last handful of years it's been LSU Cajuns, but now it's going to be LSU Tulane. So there you go.
Oh, nice.
And it'll still be in New Orleans, so that'll be a
good
crowd.
It'll still be in New Orleans. It'll still be a terrific event.
And I've also looked, last week, the Cajuns played 2 midweek games. This week, they play two midweek games.
This week is scheduled. Last week was a makeup.
Right, but regardless, they still played them. You had the weekend series, then two games in the midweek. A weekend series, two games in the midweek. A weekend series coming up. It's a lot of baseball.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just saying, you know, the team's not going to get that doesn't concern you, I guess, is what I'm asking.
No, I mean, this is what's scheduled. This is what they train for. I mean, I don't buy into wearing down. If the competition level was immense,
okay,
like if you're telling me that the Cajuns' midweek games were against LSU and Texas A&M,
right? I hear that.
That would be different, okay? Because that's a top level competition, right, that they're not accustomed to playing.
But playing Southeastern twice in the midweek and then playing Louisiana Tech and McNeese, not too concerned.
No, not too concerned. Not too concerned.
Just on that. And plus, it's an oddity in college baseball to play that. That's
and plus, their
out.
Rotation is set for the weekend, so you're going to be getting the other guys that they're trying to develop into their midweek starters, or guys that they're trying to just have eat up innings. Right. One of these games will probably be pitching by committee.
Right.
More than likely tomorrow night against McNeese. Tech has a little bit more juice to it. Both are rivals. But no, I'm not that concerned, because if you look at their schedule, they have not been plagued by that. This is an anomaly, like you said. So, yes, they had to do it last week because of the makeup game with Southeastern. They had to go to Hammond after hosting them the night before. But then you look at it, and then you look at the next week. Well, they got the Wally Pontiff Classic, and then not another midweek game next week.
Oh, see, I didn't even look that far. So, okay.
So,
I mean,
yeah,
it will balance out, I know. I just
– yeah.
That's the only reason I want to point out, because it is an oddity. You know, you do see some – multi-midweek games in there, but for it to happen on back-to-back weeks, obviously, like you said, it wasn't scheduled that way. Just something I thought maybe was worth looking at, but maybe I hope you're right and it doesn't affect them, because the midweek games, they don't mean very much, hardly anything for LSU. They mean it's just about the same for the Cajuns, but for a different reason. I mean, the Cajuns are going to have to win their conference. They're going to have to go through the Sun Belt, and if they're going to get a bid, they're either going to need to win every game from here on out or perform very well.
Yeah, but it would help to keep racking up those midweek wins to build up momentum.
Well, for momentum, yeah. But for tangible reasons, for things that a committee is going to look at to put UL in a regional or not.
Oh, with their record and no.
I don't think these midweek games really mean that much.
Yeah, they have to probably
win
their conference
tournament.
But you need
to win them for not just momentum, but confidence for your team, because I think UL is trending up right now, and you don't want to see that change.
And here's the other thing about the midweek games, I've always argued. This is also where gives you the opportunity to have your younger players develop with in-game experience during the season.
Right.
Because whether it's guys coming off the bench that are going to get some play in the field or get some at-bats, or the pitchers that you won't be using during the conference tournament,
right,
but they need the reps, that's how you develop. You can go through the training and the off-season conditioning and all that stuff, and that's great. You develop with experience, in-game experience. So that's why the midweek games are important to me, because that's where you get your younger guys the reps that they needed. Perfect example, go back to LSU. Paul Maneri and that staff need Landon Marceau to get back on track. They need him to get his confidence. That's where the midweek game comes in, where he can go out there and have a good outing, get his mojo back. That's why it's so important.
Yeah, because not every kid is going to have a moment like C.J. Willis, where the bat's put in his hands in the middle of a weekend series, big time at bat, and he hits it off the wall, and that's how you get in the lineup. That is the exception to
Correct.
The rule. Most of the time you're going to need a kid to get a hit against a Southern or a Louisiana Tech, and then maybe you kind of get him going. So
that's why I'm always a big fan of the midweek games. It helps the development of the players.
There you go.
Because not everyone comes in like Antoine Duplantis and just is like, I own this place. Like that's a rarity, right? Some guys, they're going to take their lumps. There's going to be some ups and downs. When we come back, we will close out this edition of the Rap Game with RP3 with the Cajun Kiwi himself. Masters preview coming up with Craig Perks right here on 103.7 The Game.
Patrick Reed collects himself. He has this par putt to win the Masters. Takes one more look down the line. Ball on its way, and it's in. Patrick Reed with a par at 18. A big hug with his caddy. He holds off all challengers, doffs his cap to the patrons. Rory McIlroy walks over to congratulate him. And Patrick Reed has won the 82nd Masters.
Welcome back to the Rap Game with RP3. right here on 103.7 The Game. It's that time of year where we hear Jim Nantz talk about azaleas and pine straw, and the world puts its focus on Augusta, Georgia, for one of the most prestigious golf tournaments in the world and the first major of the 2019 season, the Masters. And helping us preview that said tournament is a man who played it three times and the host of Perks of the Game, our very own Craig Perks. Craig, thank you for joining me, brother. How are you this morning?
I'm very well, sir. Everything is good. It is Masters Week, and we've waited, I don't know, 250 days since the last major, all the way back to the PGA at Belle Reve. So, you know, we think of the Masters as golf's rite of spring. We're glad it's finally here, and we can't wait to see Magnolia Lane and Amen Corner. And you talked about the azaleas and the dogwood and Hello Friends from Jim Nantz and everything that goes along with Augusta National.
It's a tremendous time of the year. Final Four wraps up, and then we go right into the Masters, Craig. One of the things I found interesting that's kind of been a recent trend there with the Masters is it has become the place for first-time major winners, whether it was Patrick Reed last year, Sergio the year before, Danny Willett before that. Bubba Watson won his first major there. Adam Scott broke through in 2013 with his first major finally. What is it about the Masters recently in the last 10 years or so that has become kind of the breakthrough place all of a sudden? It seems a little surprising that the Masters has become the breakthrough major for a lot of these golfers.
Well, I think the greatest thing about Augusta National and the Masters is that it's so exacting. And, you know, you need to have all aspects of your game, not just on song, but at your very best. And I think it is such a huge event. It is probably the best event, the biggest event in our sport. And it means so much. And I just think that you have to be able to handle not only the enormity of the situation, the difficulty of the golf course, but just the aura, the mystique of the place. And, you know, you think of Patrick Reed last year, who played collegiately at the University of Georgia in Augusta State, so was familiar with that area. You know, Sergio had played there 25 times, you know. But then you go to guys like Danny Willett showing up for the first time and Adam Scott break the first Australian to win. So I don't think there's a rhyme or reason why. I just think it's such an exacting test. You have to have, you know, not the obviously the physical side, but complete control, the mental game. You know, you walk around that place, there is that mystique and that aura, and it can be overwhelming. It can sort of drag your mind away from the task at hand. I think the guys that handle that that particular year end up donning the green jacket.
We're on with Craig Perks, host of Perks of the Game, breaking down this year's Masters. Let's talk a little bit about the field. Odds are out. Now, odds on favorite is the two are Rory McIlroy and DJ Dustin Johnson. Not surprising there. They're the long ball hitters. And I'm not surprised by that. Do you feel that they are in your opinion, Craig, are they the odds on favorites for you to win the Masters, or do you think it's someone else that's in the field?
Yeah, I think that I was looking at this, a lot of sabermetrics. You think in baseball there's a lot of sabermetrics, but there was this, I found this website, golfdata.ga, and they were talking about strokes gain. Now, that's the metric on the PGA Tour, and they looked at strokes gain when you're at your best, how many appearances at Augusta National, and it peaked between 7 and 9. That's when you're at your best. You've got all the experience you ever needed, Augusta. You're probably at your prime in your golfing life. And it's amazing guys are in that, DJ's in that that time frame. So is Justin Rose. So is Rory McIlroy. So is Jason Day. I think if you look at if you go down to those sabermetrics, you look at the number one player in the world, Justin Rose, Dustin Johnson, Rory McIlroy, those are your top three. You look at the odds makers from Vegas, Dustin Johnson, Rory McIlroy,
right.
Justin Rose. For me personally, it's a small group. I think if you looked, it's probably a handful, maybe 10 guys that can win this. And I think that if you go down the world rankings and you go down the odds, they're all in line. I like the guy to meet, to be honest with you, and I've probably championed this guy for the last three or four. It's Justin Rose. He's just made the number one in the world. But there was a stat by Sean Martin on Twitter yesterday saying the last 4 years he's been second in greens in regulation at Augusta National. Your iron game has to be superb around there because you're not going to hit every green.
Right.
But when you do miss the greens, you have to miss it in the right spot. It's not an exacting golf course off the tee. So the iron game is important. Justin Rose has two second-place finishes. You talk about Sergio. Justin Rose was in that playoff to Sergio Garcia. I think the Englishman being number one in the world, it hasn't happened a lot. I think it's only been Ian Woosnam, Fred Couples, and Tiger who have been number one player in the world to win the green jacket on the Sunday. So I think Justin Rose, to me, is the man to beat this week.
Craig, I appreciate it. That goes against my pick. I picked Tommy Fleetwood.
Not a bad pick.
I like him, and I'm also rooting for Ricky. Craig, appreciate you, brother. Y'all stay tuned right here on 103.7 The Game. Perks of the Game is up next.